With MSO News, I'm Rick Moore, talking now with State Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr. Senator Tarr, welcome back to Boston and to Boston. How about welcome back to MSO, and how are things in Boston?
Well, you know, it's great to be back with you, Rick. Always great to have a chance to talk about what's happening in state government. And things are very busy, actually, on Beacon Hill right now. The legislature is putting all of the pieces together that enable us to operate for the coming 2 years. We began the legislative session actually on New Year's Day with our inauguration, and now we are in the process of working on things like rules and establishing committees and, again, putting together all the mechanics of how the legislature operates. And one of the things that's going to come up fairly quickly is a supplemental budget that has been filed by Governor Healey to address a number of deficiencies in state accounts. And that will probably get taken up even before we debate a lot of the rules by the House and the Senate, because those bills need to be paid in some way, shape, or form. So there is a lot happening as we speak today.
Well, a major headline yesterday, I believe it was, in the papers and on the websites, was the fact that the supplemental budget that hasn't been approved yet forced the shelter money is gone. Money's to take care of the shelters, and so that needs to be addressed, I'm sure, and it's something to the tune of over $400 million or something like that.
It's a very substantial amount, Rick, and we're estimating that if you look at the calendar year that spans last year and this year, we're going to spend probably about $1 billion on the shelter system, and that's a significant increase than what has been spent in years past. And that's concerning because it affects our ability to fund other priorities when we have an unanticipated expense of that nature that's consuming so many of our dollars. But along with that, there's an extensive discussion about how to reform the shelter system, and we hopefully can talk about that at some point in the future to make sure that folks are getting into the system that are appropriate to be in the system, and that it's sustainable and that it's safe. Because we've also seen a number of highly publicized reports of some violent incidents that have happened, and we need to make sure that they don't continue to happen to the greatest extent possible.
Well, another headline has been coming out of the state auditor's office frequently concerning transparency. There's a headline today about several hundred million dollars was discovered in welfare fraud, but transparency is something that has been a major topic, or at least it's a major topic coming out of the auditor's office anyway.
No doubt about it, and the auditor has the responsibility for auditing all of the state accounts, and this report is very concerning. This is the kind of audit that's done on a regular basis, and it oftentimes reveals fraud, and oftentimes it informs or helps to inform measures to prevent that fraud from occurring in the future. And so we're just getting this report, and we're just delving into it, but I'm confident that it's going to get a lot of attention, as it should, and we think about, again, how to make sure that the benefits that are being paid out by our welfare system are going to those who are deserving of them and who we intend to support, and not going to those who would try to obtain them fraudulently. That's a fundamental question of integrity in the system, and I suspect that we're going to have a lot to look at in this report and a lot to think about to make sure that we're doing everything possible to make sure, again, that the program has integrity.
So what's an update with respect to the rules debate?
So this is one of the things, Rick, that I think doesn't get enough attention in the public sphere, and it's important to talk about, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about it. So as we begin the two-year legislative session, as I mentioned, that began on New Year's Day of this year, one of the first things that we have to do is establish the rules by which the House and the Senate operate, and by which the House and the Senate operate when we're acting together. And those rules are critically important to transparency and to efficiency, and they govern every legislative thing that we do, every bill that gets filed, how it gets treated, how it gets reported, how it gets voted on, how the sessions operate. And so I think this is a particularly important subject, and I'm hoping by sharing some of this information with you and your listeners, Rick, that we're able to bring some more attention to it. So in the next couple of weeks, we will have a debate in the House and a debate in the Senate about two sets of rules. The rules that govern the particular branch where they're being debated. So the House has its own set of rules, and the Senate has its own set of rules. And then there are joint rules, and those joint rules affect things like the various committees of the legislature, who often are joint committees. The way conference committee reports, reconciliations of different versions of a bill are dealt with, a whole host of things that may seem a bit mundane, but in the end are critically important. And so there is a temporary rules committee in the Senate, which is now considering all of those rules changes. I expect that it will make a report soon, and then we'll have the debate that I described, probably very soon. And it's a rare opportunity, comes only once every 2 years, that we have the chance, Rick, to increase transparency. And on Inauguration Day, when the Senate President was sworn in, when I was sworn in, we each made a commitment to try to pursue increased transparency. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. So one of the things that we're trying to do is increase the time for people to read a conference committee report. As we've talked about in the past, oftentimes conference committee reports take a very long period of time to negotiate between the House and the Senate when they have different versions of a bill. But oftentimes they're released in a very hurried kind of a way, and folks don't have a lot of time to read the conference committee report. Now, currently, the rules specify that the report has to be filed by 8 p.m., and then it can be taken up by the House and the Senate after 1 p.m. the following afternoon. I just don't think that's enough time. So we are proposing, I am proposing, that we have 48 hours to look at that conference committee report and that it be posted on the web for 48 hours so people have a chance to read it as well and let us know what they think about it. One of the other things that we've done, I think too often, is had sessions that go all night and into the following morning. And I don't think that helps folks see what's going on when we're meeting in the late hours of the night, the early hours of the morning. Currently, we have a rule that says it takes a two-thirds vote to go past midnight in the Senate. I am proposing that we change that to unanimous consent so that any member can object. And if that objection happens, we'd be forced to come in the following day, when, again, we're doing things in the normal course of business during regular business hours. One more thing, Rick. Oftentimes, we talk about conference committees, and we know that they go into executive session when the discussion and the negotiation is shielded from public view. I am proposing, and my caucus is proposing, that to go into executive session would require a two-thirds vote of the members of the conference committee, so that it would not be as routine an occurrence and would require a specific vote to happen. So there are many of these. I am going to release very shortly this afternoon a memo that has about 26 proposed rule changes in it. And hopefully folks will be able to look at this and reach out to their legislators. And my hope is that we're going to be able to get some increased transparency in this rules debate and in this session.
What's the process for adopting a rule?
So it's a majority vote in the Senate, and what will happen in this case, the Senate will likely go first in debating its own rules and the joint rules. Once the debate is concluded in the Senate, whatever we adopt become the new rules. If they're joint rules, then they go over to the House. The House gets to debate them. And then we go into a conference committee to negotiate them as we would other bills. So we've got a little bit of a way to go. But the short answer is a simple majority vote can make a rules change and adopt a new rule.
I should have paid more attention in my civics class, Senator. I got to...
Now, Rick, you were a phenomenal teacher at helping a lot of us that struggle with math understand math. And I was one of them. So, you know, it's okay that you may not have focused as much on this. But again, because sometimes these are not as glamorous as other subjects that we talk about, they don't get much attention But hopefully that will change.
Well, I appreciate learning from you. It's a wonderful thing that I'm able to do here with you. I appreciate it. Let me ask you about a topic that I've been following for the last couple of years now, and it reminds me of the days when Plum Island would get flooded out and houses would get washed away. And it also, it makes me reminisce a little bit about the wildfires in California that happen all the time. And it has to do with weather. And we're talking about Salisbury Beach because I know that you've been involved with restoring the dunes up at Salisbury Beach and trying to replenish the coastline up there. And once again, it got slammed. So what's the latest update on that?
You know, Rick, oftentimes when we see those things in the media, we see flooding, we see a wildfire, we think, are we at the whim of nature? And is there anything we can do? And the good news is that oftentimes there are things we can do to be proactive. We can try to address drought conditions, which contribute to wildfires. We can try to develop solutions that make dune systems more sustainable. And that's exactly what we're doing at Salisbury Beach. So we were about 2 years in the planning process of designing a project to repair the dunes that have been damaged by coastal erosion and make them more sustainable for the future. And we're very grateful to the Healey administration for releasing about $1.75 million to help to do that, because Salisbury Beach is a public resource and folks from all around the Merrimack Valley and really all around the world come to Salisbury Beach in the summer to make those precious memories that can happen at a visit to the beach with your family. But in addition to that, Salisbury Beach protects Route 1A, which is an emergency escape route for the Salisbury, or the Seabrook, rather, nuclear power station. It protects the town of Salisbury and the city of Newburyport, and it protects portions of the Great Marsh, which are incredibly important to carbon sequestration to help us combat climate change. So for all those reasons, it's important for us to have the best functioning dune system that we can. And so we embarked on a project a couple of months ago to be able to rebuild badly damaged portions of the dune, to increase their height and to make their slope more gradual. Because when you make the slope more gradual, you make the dune more resilient, because wave energy dissipates as a wave travels up the slope of the dune. And that's exactly what we're seeing with about half of this project completed. It's about 8,400 linear feet. We've got about 4,400 linear feet completed. And what we're seeing is tremendous sand accretion, not just the sand that we're putting on the beach, but the sand that's being accreted as a result of the profile of the dune that I just described. And so it's very, very positive. The problem that we're experiencing right now is that we had an original contract with the supplier of the sand, which is located in Ossipee, New Hampshire, for about 29,000, 30,000 cubic yards of sand, and we've used all of that. And so now we need to source some more sand, and it has to be sand that's compatible with what's on the beach. And so we have several sources now being tested, samples being tested, to make sure that the grains of sand are compatible. And hopefully we'll be able to restart work in a couple of weeks and be able to finish this project so that it will be done by the summer season and we won't have to worry about interfering with migratory shorebirds or other environmental concerns. And we'll have a beach that is sustainable and people can enjoy it once again over the course of the summer. But right now, we do face a particular challenge with identifying some additional sand that we can source. And there's also a change order for the project that needs to be approved by the administration so that we can continue moving forward and purchase that additional sand that we need. So it's been a very positive outcome so far, and we're hoping to resume progress and resume our efforts very shortly and have them done by spring.
It sounds very hopeful. That sounds great. Finally, Senator, I did pay attention in history class, and I know that Rosa Parks, some people may not even know the name, but a very important person in history going back 70 years or so ago, which began really, I think, to change the course of American history with respect to how the black community was able to be recognized. And I know Lyndon Johnson pushed that big time. But here in the state of Massachusetts, Governor Healey has proclaimed today Rosa Parks Day. And, of course, this is Black History Month.
You know, it's very important, Rick, that we recognize those that have changed the course of history, and particularly with Rosa Parks, to do so during Black History Month. But I also often like to remind us all that Black history or African-American history is American history. And it's a history for all of us. We've traveled on this journey together as a nation, and, you know, we've dealt with some very difficult things and some things that have been a big challenge. And we need to remember that there wasn't always that kind of equality in this country, and we need to still continue to work on equality. But we also need to remember that individuals like Rosa Parks that had tremendous character and fortitude, with a form of civil disobedience in particular, changed the course of history and moved us closer to that great dream of equality in this nation that we were founded upon and that we're still pursuing. And it's important to reflect on that contribution and reflect on that concept and think about what Rosa Parks did and how difficult it was at the time. And in that context, think about what we can all continue to do now to advance that great legacy and move us even closer to the great American promise of equality for everyone.
Massachusetts State Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr. With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore.